That's right.
South Carolina. I love it. It's so pretty.
You just heard it, folks. Carol Townsend loves South Carolina, folks. She's a true Southerner. She's been speaking today out there at the Women's Luncheon, the Festival of Flowers Luncheon. And how'd it go today, Carol?
Oh, it was so much fun. I love speaking to groups of women, and this was a very receptive audience. A lot of fun women there.
Okay. Why do you like speaking to women?
I know. Good point. We'll clear that up.
Okay.
Women are fun. I can relate to women. I am in my mid to upper 50s, so I've got a little bit of experience under my belt. So I typically end up talking to groups of women and about that age group. And so we get it. We get each other. We get how we got here. We get what our struggles are and what our triumphs are. And I don't know, I reach them, I think, better than I reach any other audience.
Yeah, it would be hard to reach those young people today, wouldn't it?
Without a phone, yes, it would be very hard.
If you texted your speech to them, maybe they would pay attention, right?
Or social media that I don't understand, like Snapchat. Maybe that's even not a thing anymore, but I never understood it to begin with, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, I wanted to have you on because you've written some books. You made a career change at 40.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what were you doing before 40? You were in the corporate world?
I was. I was director of marketing for a large software company. And I found that everything I did in that job boiled down to I crafted all the communication, verbal and written, and presentations, things like that. It always came down to me. I've always loved to write since I was a little girl. And you mentioned I made this change at 40. With me and other women I've spoken with, we reached blinding clarity at age 40. Boy, I did. I thought, what in the heck am I doing? I love to write. Yes, I was earning a wonderful salary with a great company. My kids were in middle school. And man, if there's ever a time that they need mom or dad home when they leave and home when they arrive back, it's in middle school. Those are awful years. And I thought, I've always had this in the back of my mind. I love to write. I don't want to be on my deathbed someday and think, man, I wish I had given it a shot, you know? So 40 hit, and there, I did it.
And you went on, and you've written several books.
I have, yes.
What books have you written now? What are they about?
My first book is about family humor. And it's, I will say, the title's
awful.
Oh,
the farts?
That would be a step up. It's about family humor. And the title of the book is Southern Fried White Trash. I understand that offends some people. But in the context of my family growing up, my mother had 7 kids. She did not sit there and give you a 2-hour speech on behavior. She would smack you in the back of the head and say, don't act like white trash. So I just had that in my head. This, you have certain ways of behaving and ways that you don't. Well, my husband, and I adore him, and he's a brilliant man. I married him, and let's just say that our families are very, very, very different. And for 2 years, I would just sit with my mouth agape thinking, I've never seen that before. I've never heard that before. I've never seen people say or do things like this before. And in all honesty, I wrote this manuscript to just, it was kind of a 1-800 am I crazy check. Like, I'm going to get this on paper and then I'll feel better. And I really put the manuscript in a box under the bed, and my husband found it.
Uh-oh.
And read it and laughed. And he's not a reader. He'll read technical things and that's it. And when he read it, he said, you've got to publish this. And I said, honey, you do get it, right? I love his family. We're
right.
Just very different. And so we went ahead and published the book. And I will say that was back in 2010, I believe. Still a very strong seller. And here's why. It's family humor. Everybody gets it. Everybody's got people in their family that act the way the people do about whom I'm writing.
Such as?
Well, say, you know, how do we act at a wedding, or how we all go crazy at a funeral or a family reunion or holidays, you know?
Holidays are one of the most stressful events that there are in
life.
High
stress.
Yes.
And I asked an Atlanta counselor, because I saw it was such a common theme. I said, why? You know, Christmas, I love Christmas. Why does it always turn out to be such a nightmare? I mean, it's exhausting, and it's not just in our family. And he said, think about it this way. I thought this was smart. He said, you all grow up under the same roof. Then you get older and you move out and you create your own homes.
Right.
But then you all come back to mom and dad's for Christmas or Thanksgiving. And everybody reverts to the ages that they were. You could be 35, but when you go home and you're the middle brother or the younger sister, and all the insults and the picking and the things that
the
you thought
order.
You had, the things you thought you had moved past, they all come to life under mom and dad's roof. Your parents are still trying to parent you while they're letting your kids get away with murder. And then we pour alcohol in the whole mess, and we wonder why it's such a mess. So I thought that was a very good point.
Absolutely.
So it's just, that's family humor. It's just kind of knee slapping. Yeah, I've got that uncle. Yeah, that one's been a nice, successful little book.
And that was your first book.
Mm-hmm.
So that must have motivated you to go on to write a second book.
It did. I love to tell stories. And my second book is the one that I call my baby. It's titled Red Lipstick and Clean Underwear. And as women usually pick up on immediately, it's a book about mama's advice, and advice that's passed on to us from aunts and grandmothers. And
always put on clean underwear, because you never know when you're going to be
the
in an accident.
Wreck. Yes, you get it. Men just scratch their heads and say, what? So, but my mother died when I was very young, so I've always been fascinated by this passed down knowledge and wisdom. And does it help us? Does it hurt us? Does it put us in therapy? Does it mess us up? Does it give us any advantages in life? And in order, I research everything. I'm a researcher and I love it. So I threw wine and cheese parties in places where people knew me and places where they didn't. And women came and they talked to me and they told me some of the funniest advice. I thought maybe out west or up north, it might be a little different than it is here in the South, but a lot of the things were the same about never leave the house without your lipstick. You never know who you'll run into. Certainly the underwear thing. And then there were some that were very different that I had never heard before.
Well, give us an example.
Well, a lady from Boston said her mom always told her if she wore earrings when she went outside, she wouldn't catch a cold. Now, I'm from Georgia, so that's not an issue.
Right.
But yeah, I mean,
Who knew?
Another lady that I met at the beach when I was down there writing said her mom always told her, if you eat the crusts of the bread, you'll be pretty.
Interesting.
Yeah. So these are usually all rooted in some sort of wisdom or lore or fact, but it's interesting the things that women pass down one generation to the next. I remember something my mom told us always. Just learn a little bit of typing, a little bit of shorthand.
You'll
enough to
have
support yourself and until you get married, and then you'll be taken care of. Heavens to Betsy, what kind of knowledge is that? I mean, and how many of us followed it? Now, she had always encouraged me to go to college, and thankfully I didn't take that knowledge. But I do remember her telling me that she loved that I loved to write, but when I told her I wanted to be a writer for a career, she just would shake her head and say, you can't make a living telling stories and drawing pictures. You just can't make a living doing that. And that's probably the reason I got into it so late, but you know, everything for a reason.
When did your mother die in relationship to your life?
She got very ill with leukemia when I was 12. And actually, she was given about 6 weeks to live. So she lived 3.5 years.
Oh, my goodness.
But, man, she fought for him. It was awful, really awful.
Well, I just was. So she never got to know that you actually have made it successful as a
writer. No. And my older sister says, she always tells me mom would be so proud. And I have a sister who's 20 years older than I am. So, and I'm grateful for that. She's been both a mom and a sister to me. So she tells me that mom would be very proud of college when she passed away. And she was sick for so long, she really wasn't there, you know,
right,
when she was alive. So, you know, when I tell women all the time, gosh, if you still have your mom, oh, Treasure it. Treasure it. You'll miss it.
That's true. And, you know, the one of the things I was reading, I read one of the articles, I was reading some of the articles you wrote for the Gwinnett paper.
Yes.
And one of them I read was about fathers.
Yes.
About Father's Day. Yeah. And, you know, you're just talking about treasuring your mom. But, you know, our fathers, they do have the image of, you don't know what's going on.
Well, in my dad's case, it was more than an image. Bless him. He, you know, Daddy was from the generation. He was born in 1919. You know, we lost him in 2013. Mm-hmm. He was 93 years old. Wow. And honestly, he just wound down, you know, like an old clock. If there's a way to go, I think that would be it. But he was a dad, you know, in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And their job
was to make money.
And, you know, you might be aware that your kids are in school. You probably didn't know what grade they were in. And heaven forbid, you know, their teacher's name. And, you know, my mom was in the corporate world, but she still cooked, and she was at school functions, and it was all on her.
Yeah, why did we have to be the 24-hour women?
Yeah.
You know, remember that commercial came out about that I can fry up the bacon? Yeah. Yes, and I can do this.
I've written an article about that.
Yes.
But that's how it was.
Yeah.
And I don't know how she accomplished it all. I really don't.
Then it must have been really tough on your dad, speaking about your family, when your mother got the leukemia.
Oh, gosh. He was very fortunate to work for, at the time, the company was named Burroughs Corporation. And later, I think they merged with Sperry and became Unisys. But he had been with them for so long. They really cut him a lot of slack as far as spending time with mom in the hospital and needing to be off to take her from, you know, one appointment to another. And then after mom died, gosh, I don't even think it was a year, and my dad retired at 55.
So wow.
She had left him in a position to be able to do that. So he kind of became mom/dad. And
how did he cope with that world, mom/dad?
You know, I think God smiled on our family because I was leaving for college in Nashville. So I would be close to my sister geographically, who lived there, my sister that's 20 years older, which left my dad and my brother at home alone. So that made it easier for my father. I think he was a little upset with me initially because I was chief cook, you know, house cleaner, and I saw where that was going real quick.
Better escape while I can.
So, you know, it probably appeared to be a selfish thing to do, but I did leave and go to school in Nashville. But they actually had a great time. The house became kind of a bachelor pad. I always said my mom would turn in her grave. She had a beautiful dining room with beautiful art. My father took it all down and put three mounted largemouth bass up on the dining room wall. But when you're sitting at the table, you're looking up into their gills. It's horrid. Horrid.
Thank God you went to college.
Yeah, I just got out of that. Yeah. Yeah. Wow. I think they ate a lot of, you know, SpaghettiOs and Beanie Weenies and were happy to do so.
And they probably had a really good relationship because they probably from a bonding standpoint.
Yeah, they did. They did. So it worked out well. It worked out well for all of us.
Well, that's terrific. So you decided at 40 to become an author. What did you major in college?
Undergraduate school English, graduate school journalism. I'm sorry, undergraduate was psychology with a minor in English. Graduate was journalism.
And what did you want? What did you think you were going to do before you got into this corporate world and everything?
I think we are in college too young. And I will say I started college when I was 16 years old. I had no more business choosing a major. I thought a major was something you like to do. It never entered my mind. Ooh, this is going to start me on a career path. What are you going to do as an English major? I don't know, really. So I didn't think about that. It's as embarrassing as that is to say. I kind of Forrest Gumped my way into some great jobs. And people ask me all the time, you know, how did you become an author? And when did you get traditionally published? And how did you get an agent? And I literally tripped and fell backwards into it. It's a very tough business to get into.
Exactly.
I just tell people, be at the right place at the right time, show up where it makes sense, be at literary festivals and book signings and writers clubs. And if you're persistent enough, you will make it.
You know, I think it's interesting you say about going to college. You went at 16 and you were just doing something that you liked. I think it is a travesty that we have children that in the 7th and 8th grade are having to make up their minds on what they're going to major and what they are going to do with their lives. And I just go,
ridiculous.
Why?
Ridiculous.
Yeah.
That has to be a political answer to an educational question. Usually that's where the really funny answers come from. They can't pick out what they're going to wear to school that morning. And if they do, they agonize over it. You have no more business choosing a career path or thinking about your future in the 7th grade than a man in the moon. Why? I mean, I get that it's politically, it sounds good, and maybe, but it just makes no sense. It's silly.
Well,
it's like asking my golden retriever, you know, what she's going to major in. I don't know.
Fun? Go get the ball?
Yeah, squirrels, like that. Bones? You're going to, same answer.
Yeah, but they do. And, you know, I think the other thing that impresses me is, though, at such a young age, they become little adults. You know, they are, it's some are so advanced for their years. And you just go, why aren't you being a kid right
just
now?
Just be a kid. You know, I think some kids, you know, we're all wired differently. Some kids are just born old souls. Some kids are not ever going to let their hair down and play and get filthy and goofy and get in just a little bit of trouble. They're just not. They're not wired that way. But I think when we take away the option to do that. You know, when I hear they're taking away physical education in school and taking away art, music, things like that, it bothers me because public education already tries to hammer a lot of square pegs into round holes anyway. And if
Right.
you don't give kids at least the privilege of moving around a little bit, and heaven knows we all need the exercise, but the expression of arts, some of us, that's just how we're wired.
Exactly.
So you grow up thinking, I'm really stupid because I don't do well in school, when it's the school that's failing the kid. Who was it? Albert Einstein said, well, if you define intelligence by being able to fly, then everything but a bird is really stupid. That's not an exact quote, but, you know.
I like it, though.
You can't measure everything by the same stick, and every kid has a gift.
That's right. And I think that is some of what's wrong with education, is that we don't recognize that. And so we have children that end up dropping out of school because they don't think they have the possibilities. They're not the smart ones, shall we say.
Right. They're not the smart ones. And let's factor in the rampant bullying. Who wants to go and put up with that every day? But oh my gosh, I wish children could understand there's so much more to being successful in this life than your SAT score or what you made on that algebra test. Of course, apply yourself always. Anything worth having is worth working for, but life ain't over if you got a D in history because you just hate history.
Well, yes.
Your teacher probably stinks because history's fascinating.
Well, yeah, and you know, the very fact that our technical schools are now coming on stronger with teaching skills and manufacturing, you know, one of the things we're dealing with right here in South Carolina and in Greenwood is not having enough students, adults, young adults, ready to go to work for these technical companies. So this, we are building a big tech center. We're doing all these things because we need the person that doesn't necessarily want to go to college. They want to just get a job and be good at something and enjoy the rest of their life doing other things.
You know, college is not for everybody. My husband and I owned a plumbing company for 20 years. My husband is a plumber / engineer by trade. And in Atlanta, of course, very hot market, very lucrative market. We ended up selling not because we couldn't get work, but because we couldn't get plumbers.
I believe
it. There are people out there that know just enough to be dangerous. It's not taught in any of the technical schools at the high school or college level. So if it's not passed down, I mean, all the good licensed master plumbers are aging out. And you've got a bunch of kids that have been told 4-year school or have a nice life. There's no in between. you can make a strong salary, six figures easily if you've got half cents and know how to do plumbing or heating and air or electrical.
Or welding. Sure. Welding. Oh, my God. Welding. There you go.
Let's get on welding. They brought welders in from Sweden to work on Plant Vogel in Georgia because they couldn't find enough in Georgia.
Oh, my God.
They brought them in from Sweden.
Wow.
So, well, we've done our kids a disservice in that respect.
We certainly have. Well, when we come back, we are going to be talking more with Carol Townsend. She's written another fascinating book that she just finished, a year ago, 2 years ago now?
Blood in the Soil.
Blood in the Soil.
Yes.
And that covers a very interesting topic. I won't say what it's about. You'll have to keep tuned in with us right here on WCRS. So you keep it right here. Carol is here. If you've got a question, I've got Jeff on the telephone lines, 229-7984. That's 229-7984. Remember, blood in the soil. The antique vintager has arrived in Greenwood. He's been in Greenwood, but he's been incognito. Now unveiled for the very first time, the antique vintager, the one and only Jeff Eller, is debuting on the national stage with his podcast. Shouldn't you be one of the first to come in and see him and see what you have with What's It Worth? Can you sell it? Do you want to sell it? And should you sell it? Only the antique vintager can tell you such things. So come and see us at 637 Durst Avenue East. Call first for your appointment. 864-229-6613. The antique vintager Jeff Eller is in the building. Oh, that's right. We're right back here, WCRS, having a great afternoon talking with Carol Townsend. She is an author. She was the 53rd Georgia Author of the Year Awards. That was pretty awesome.
That was very awesome. Yeah, such an honor. It's such a surprise. Yeah.
Yeah. And you wrote a book that this is about, that we want to talk some about. Blood in the Soil. Sounds nasty. What's it about? I mean, that sounds like a crime book, and you've been talking humor.
I know. Blood in the Soil is a crime book. It's a true crime book about the story behind the 1978 shooting of Larry Flint in Gwinnett County, Georgia.
Hustler Magazine.
Yes, Hustler Magazine's Larry Flint. And that incident happened when I was 16. So it always stuck in my memory. I didn't know who he was, but I knew his being in Georgia was a big deal. And especially after the shooting. Oh, my gosh. It was a circus, media circus. And so once I became a journalist, a newspaper journalist, and I had a good reputation with the district attorney, I had an opportunity to review the files from that case back in 78. And I was stunned at what I was reading, because when you start researching, it could fizzle out into nothing. It could be a dead end. It could be just a boring story. But I was riveted by police reports and FBI profile reports. And I thought, why? As I was reading, I thought, surely somebody has told this story. And they hadn't. In fact, we all knew he had been shot, but to my knowledge, we didn't know why. People assumed that it was because Larry Flint is who he is, and, you know, abrasive and
sex,
obnoxious, and yes, some raunchy porn. And so I think people assumed that and were happy with that answer. That had nothing to do with why he was shot. And
nothing to do with it?
No, nothing to do with it. And the truth behind the story is it's so relevant today, sadly. I can't give it away because I really want y'all to go get my book, Blood in the Soil.
Okay.
But I promise you, you will be shocked and surprised, and you'll understand what I mean when I say that story is just as relevant today as it was 40-something odd years ago.
It is amazing when you look at the society today and the politics, and then we go back to the 70s and even the 60s. Some of the themes are there. Mm. Yeah, exactly. So was it difficult to write this book because you'd written fun, humorous books?
I'll tell you what was difficult. The research I found fascinating. The writing I found very easy because I researched it very thoroughly. The difficult part of writing this book was some of the language that I had to use in order to tell the story accurately.
I mean, I guess you're talking about off color.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
You know, some profanity, but even worse, some words that are just... they're just not good words. That they right. were prevalent in the South, well, everywhere, but the South is known for these words being used. And I'll never forget sending my agent the first draft. And my agent lives in Rhode Island. And
as a Yankee.
A very protected, secluded Yankee, I think. I've had to explain quite a few things to him as he's read my book. But he ran across this word and was furious and called and said, do you have to use that word? And I said, you know, it took me 2 days, two full days to be able to put it on paper. I hate the word, but I'm talking about the 1970s in Georgia, a white supremacist. I mean, this guy, the Nazi party was too calm and laid back for him. So I'm sorry, but the story is not believable if I use the term African American when he is referring to certain people.
Well, we know what word you're using.
Yes.
Yes.
I just hate to say it, and it truly took me two days to put the word on paper. But if you're going to tell a story, tell it accurately or don't tell it at all. And I think we really, it's our responsibility, because the second we start whitewashing and pretending and glossing things over, then the next generation believes that it didn't happen. And that generation.
Well, I could lead to a whole discussion about monuments and everything else.
I know, but yeah, if we pretend it didn't happen, the danger is repeating it, because you don't fix mistakes until you've learned what the problem is. So, yeah, be honest about it. And I think these things should be dragged out into the sunlight and examined and discussed. Because if we pretend they didn't happen, I promise you, it's human nature. We're going to be right back like it never happened. Those are teaching tools. They're not.
Sure.
They're not. Honoring those people. They should be teaching tools for all of us. But I digress.
But we've done a lot of that today. But so in the book, this has, I guess it has to do something about him being a white supremacist then, more than about his magazine and Hustler and everything.
Right, the shooter.
The shooter.
Yeah, so white supremacist. So it does all tie in.
And what happened to the shooter?
After that shooting, nothing. He escaped while literally they were closing streets right behind him. He was eventually executed in the state of Missouri in 2013, I believe.
And what did he get executed for?
Murder.
Murder? Okay.
Yeah. There were states standing in line to get a shot at him. And I guess, you know, you can only kill somebody so many times. No pun intended.
Yeah, there you go.
But yeah, for murder there as well. He bargained himself into a death penalty state. So be careful what you wish for is that lesson. So that's where he was executed.
Wow. And so that's kind of how you ended up getting a hold of the file, because they were getting ready to close it, right?
Right, yeah. Right. Everywhere he had committed a crime in every jurisdiction, it's policy to pull out those files, no matter how old they are, put that final piece of paper on top with his execution date and all the particulars, and then they can be trundled away to archives. Because technically in Gwinnett County, technically it was still an open case.
Wow. Well, what's on the agenda next then? Did that one make you feel like you needed to just I can't write anymore for a while.
You know, that one was exhausting. And I will say that there are some characters that you write that tend to live on in your head once you've actually finished the book. So that one was exhausting, but it was fascinating to write. And if I ever run across another case like that, that I think the story is begging to be told, I'll probably do it. I still write my column weekly, which is mostly humorous, so I get my fix of humor there. I am writing a historical account now, slated for a June 2019 release.
What's that about?
It's a city in Georgia that commissioned me to write the history of their city. So that's cool.
I know a commissioned author.
Yes, you do.
How about that? That's pretty cool. That doesn't happen very often.
No, it doesn't. And it's really, it's a writer's and a researcher's dream. Yeah. And it's a wonderful progressive city with a great story. So that's a lot of fun for me right now.
It's not Savannah, is it?
Mm-mm. No, it's not.
Okay, but I mean, you know, because in the darkness, what was that one about?
Oh,
the
Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. Good book.
Yeah.
Every book I write entails a lot of research because I teach a workshop once or twice a year when I get the chance. And I tell my students, I don't care what you're writing, if it's silly humor, whatever it is, you research and know your subject.
Oh, come
inside
on. Research
out.
Is easy today. You just click it up on the internet and pull it
you
up.
You know what? It's tricky. And that's what I tell them. I used to say, make sure you can double source a fact. Now I say triple, and the internet does not count. You should see the faces when I said, no, Wikipedia is not an actual source. You can log in yourself and type some stuff, and somebody else can edit it or whatever. But yeah, the internet is not. You can find great stuff out there that can point you in the right direction, but no.
So how do they have to research it?
Well, in the case of this book I'm writing, you go to historical societies, and believe it or not, churches kept all the records for these young frontier towns, and they still have them. It's absolutely fascinating to me. I've got a map that shows the state of Georgia when it was the frontier. I mean, west of the Chattahoochee River on the map, it says Indian Territory. So everything from the Chattahoochee River in Georgia to the Pacific Ocean, I'm assuming, they just referred to it as being Indian Territory. And I've got stagecoach maps and just cool stuff. But most of this stuff I found in churches that have been around that long.
Wow.
Yeah.
That has to be pretty cool.
It's fascinating, yeah.
But it also has to be difficult to decide what goes in, because, I mean, it's not going to be a book that, you know, or is it going to be several volumes here?
Yeah. It's going to be a coffee table book, so you do have to be very selective about what's going to make it in. And you do, you will do so much more research than you'll actually use, but better over-research than under, I always say. Photos make up so much of a book like that. So,
yeah. Who does the photos?
Well, we're right now trying to find people who have the old black and white photos from back in the day, and that's difficult if families haven't held on to them. So the Historical Society there in Gwinnett County has been a great resource, and the Georgia Archives. I will go to them and see what I can find. But if you can generate this stuff organically, and because history to me is fascinating. I don't write name, date, place. I think that's boring. There's no wonder kids hate history in school. There are people, and if you can find the anecdotes and the people and the relationships and tell about their lives, it's an interesting read. It's a novel, you
Absolutely.
Know, if you write it that way. So
sure.
That's how this book is being written, both artfully, but factually as well.
You know, there's a gal here who she's a retired sociologist, and she wrote a fascinating book about Promised Land, which is a black black, where all the black families lived. And she had a most, she's white, and she had a most difficult time getting accepted by them. But when she finally got accepted by them, there was a treasure trove of information, mm-hmm. and they pulled out the Bibles that told this. Oh, yes. Yeah.
Those are so cool.
Yeah.
And Promised Land in Georgia?
Promised Land right here in Greenwood County.
Okay. We've got a Promised Land area where I live, and it's the same situation. So I just thought, oh, you got to be kidding me. Yeah. So, okay.
Yeah. But she did a great book on that, and just continued the relationship with the people down there. Actually became a member of their church down there. Aww. She went to church for months. I mean, I'll just tell you this one story. For months, and they just, why is she here? You know, they wouldn't accept her or anything else. And she'd bring her son, and they'd sit there, and she'd tell her son to count the number of people in church this Sunday. And he had little tasks that he was doing. Aww. And she was doing this all in the name of research. And finally, she broke through, and they realized that she really was sincere in what she was doing. And then it changed the whole relationship.
That's very cool. I think especially here in the South, we hold our cards very close to the vest. You know, keep your personal business personal. It's not, you just don't throw it out there for anybody to examine. So that doesn't surprise me that people are hesitant. It's taken me a while to break through some hesitancy to talk to me about the history and the families in this area. Just because you're right. It's like, almost like getting an animal to eat out of your hand. They've got to trust you, or they're not going to share their cherished memories. So sure. that was smart of her.
Yeah, absolutely. It was quite a breakthrough. And she went on and she did several other books based on the fact of her. She was a young professor at Lander University, mm-hmm. and just kind of broke through. And then she went up north and did some other research and this type of thing. So
interesting. Yeah. Interesting.
Very, very interesting. So you've got another book you're already working on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as we are going towards the top of the hour, I was looking through some of your articles in the Gwinnett paper, Not So Common Sense. Age is a double-edged sword. I thought, you know, what would be a better topic here than age as being a double-edged sword?
Oh, gosh, yes. Yeah. Yes, it is. I don't remember exactly what I wrote in that, but I can take an educated guess and talk about how the wisdom is a great big plus. The aches and pains kind of hold us back a little bit. But yeah, it's a fascinating topic to me is just child rearing. It's the most important job we will ever do. We are turning adults loose on the world that have been in our care. And hopefully we've done the world a favor and taught them some sense. And they're frustrating, and it's hard, and it's taxing, and it's expensive. And then when they leave, oh, it's awful. It's maybe more so for moms. My husband had the date circled on the calendar when our youngest was leaving for college. And I had the day. Oh, my gosh. In fact, our baby leaving for college was the reason I wrote my third book, which is going to sound weird. It's the book about my NASCAR experience, Magnolia, Sweet Tea, and Exhaust. I know. Weird. How on earth does that tie in? I
just
travel.
Remember, you're from Atlanta. So I know. Yeah. You go, NASCAR. Okay.
I travel a good deal. And when I travel outside the South, more often than not, people find out I'm Southern and they ask me who my favorite driver is. And I didn't know what they were talking about. It was a flight out to California, and a gentleman asked me this question yet again. And I said, what? What are you talking? I thought he meant limo driver at the, you know, on the other end of the flight. And I'm like, I know I look kind of like, what's her name? Bette Midler. But I'm not Bette Midler. I don't have a driver. So he said, no, you're a NASCAR driver. You're from the South. You've got to have a driver. And I said, do I? Why do people assume that? We had cousins when I was a kid who would always travel through Atlanta to get to Talladega. And when my mother would refer to NASCAR, she always whispered and she always put the word "the" in front of it. The NASCAR. Your cousins are here to go to the NASCAR. Like it was a disease and we didn't want to tell people about it. So I always thought it was just this big redneck, you know, ruckus, wild party. But tying this back to when our baby left for college, that guy's question prompted me. I knew I had to find a project that would absolutely engulf me because I really was not handling being an empty nester. I wasn't handling it well. And I said, I'm going to figure this NASCAR thing out. So the
so did
book
you get down in the pits and everything.
The pits, racing in the cars, under the cars with mechanics, infield camping. Well, I rode at 173 miles an hour, so to me that's racing.
Jealous.
I know. I mean, you know, in the name of research,
I was telling you about the great experiences I've had, and here you've been NASCAR riding. Darn it!
Well, you know, in the name of research, and I really wouldn't have done it, except I thought that I would really be selling this book short if I didn't. How can I write about that rush if I don't experience it? Now, I had just had knee surgery 2 months before this experience was scheduled. And on the way to Atlanta Motor Speedway, my husband just casually throws out, now you do know the doors don't open on those cars, right? And I said, what? They don't open? Why don't the doors open? Not understanding anything about physics, I guess, and ergonomics. So I'm looking at myself thinking, how are we going to get all of this in a car window with a knee that doesn't want to bend really well? So it took four young men.
And she really enjoyed it, folks.
I know. I kind of dragged it out longer than I should have.
Oh, can you hold on right there?
Oh, that really hurts. Oh, my gosh. So they got me in there and they got me out. And it was terrifying. And I was bummed when it was over because it was over very quickly. But the driver looked over at me and he said, are you okay? And I thought, I wonder why he's asking me that. Because I had tears streaming straight back from my eyes into my hairline. Because it was just, I don't know, it was a rush of adrenaline. It was more exciting than it was scary. And I am the queen of careful. So that was a cool experience. But that's the premise of the book, really, is about a suburban 50-something mom hitting the road for a year, traveling the NASCAR circuit, camping with the fans, which is an experience. Wonderful people watching. But I will tell you, from drivers, team owners, track managers, the most gracious, helpful people I have ever had the pleasure of dealing with. They were so open with everything, and it made my job a lot easier.
So who became your favorite driver?
Well, that's people continued to ask me that. And I said Clint Bowyer because he's cute. That was my answer. And I'll be darned if he didn't cheat. Well, he was accused of cheating in the very next race. So he became the bad guy. So I went and returned all my Clint Bowyer garb and bought Dale Earnhardt Jr. garb. I don't think you can go wrong with him. So...
You know, I've always wanted to be on the NASCAR tracks because you look at them and there is such a slant.
Oh,
you don't notice
gosh.
It when they're driving the cars and you're seeing it from the inside. But if you ever go to a NASCAR race and you see it, I've been to Daytona, and you just look at this thing and you go, wow.
How does it fall off? Yeah. Exactly. Centrifugal force. I can answer that for you. It's amazing. And when the driver goes into that turn, you know, you would think he'd be moving the wheel really hard right or left. It's just a bare touch. And that car is just, you know, it goes wherever he tells it to go with that little tiny steering wheel. And he said, jokingly, he goes, when we get up here to this wall, stick your hand out and touch it. I thought he was serious. I thought, well, that'll be cool. And so I started, I mean, they had the rubber netting, I guess, on the window, which prevented Genius from doing that. But he was like, no, I was just kidding. Can you imagine?
It's in the sense of research. I'm doing what I'm told here, buddy.
Exactly. It was exhilarating, though. I'm telling you, I never thought I would be an adrenaline junkie, but that was kind of cool.
Yeah. How about jumping out of a plane?
I've never had that desire. My husband, on the other hand, has, and he has harped and harped and asked and begged. And I said, you know what? when you jump out of an airplane, I then have permission to hitchhike across Europe. Well, that's never going to happen. So I thought, we've got that problem solved. He hit 50 and he had some issues, you know, as we all do when our ice skates hit dirt like that. And I thought, I'm going to get him a certificate, a gift certificate to go skydiving. And I gave it to him for Christmas. And it's still sitting in his drawer there at home. I'm sure it had an expiration date on it. So the thing is, ladies, call his bluff. Call his bluff, because he probably isn't going to do it. He still says it's on his bucket list, and I'm just like, it's up there in your drawer, dude. So have at it.
All right. Well, this is WCRS. You know, Carol, you have been a delight to have on the air. Aww. I hope that maybe someday you'll come back through and stop in and see us again on your tours through South Carolina.
I would love to. Every time I come here, I just remark about how pretty it is, how sweet and kind the people are. Very gracious. And my husband and I are looking for a place to build. And doesn't necessarily have to be in Georgia. Everybody's telling me about this lake here, so I'm going to go check it out.
Lake Greenwood.
Yeah.
It's a good one.
He really wants to be on water, and I wouldn't mind it either. So we're going to go check it out.
Well, that sounds great. So maybe we'll have you as a neighbor, and you can come in on a regular basis.
Wouldn't that be
here?
Fun? I would love fun. It. This is fun.
There you go. All right. Carol Townsend was our guest today. She's written a lot of good books. Her latest one, Blood in the Soil. You must get it. Where can they get it, Carol?
I know for a fact that the Barnes & Noble at the college, Piedmont Tech, has some right now. It's, of course, available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble.
She's a big author, folks.
Kindle, audiobooks, pretty much any.
Anywhere. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anywhere. And she wants you to read the book, so please get it. There you go. This is WCRS right here in Greenwood. Thanks so much, Carol.
Thank you.
All right. That's going to do it for us. Bye-bye, everybody.